This is the Scholar Stage, a podcast of ideas. Join me as I sit down with soldiers, statesmen, spooks, scientists, and yes, scholars, to discuss the books and scholarship that have transformed how they see our world. Our guest on the show today is Lieutenant Colonel Nate Lauterbach. Nate's a career aviation officer with the U.S. Marine Corps and has experience in a whole variety of different roles. He's done combat deployments to Afghanistan, piloted Huey helicopters, and then done a whole slew of staff work assignments. He's a recent graduate from the Marine Corps School of Advanced Warfighting, also known as SAW School, and he's currently the plans officer for the 2nd Marine Aircraft Wing in North Carolina. I've been lucky to know Nate for several years now. In my opinion, he has one of the sharpest minds in the entire U.S. Marine Corps. As listeners may know, I write on defense topics quite often. Nate's insights into military affairs often find their way into my own analysis. It is my pleasure to invite him onto the show so that he may share some of these insights with you.
Pleasure to be here, Tanner. Been following your work for many years, and I really appreciate the perspectives that you bring to a lot of things. And I'm honored to be a part of this show.
I should probably note that even though Nate works for the Department of Defense, the U.S. Marine Corps, what he says here today does not represent anything official by the U.S. government. They're his opinions only. Now, we're going to be discussing a book that both of us find pretty important for understanding what the Marine Corps is trying to do and also perhaps the future of U.S.-China competition. And this book is by Wayne Hughes, and it is called Fleet Tactics and Naval Operations. Let me ask you, Nate, who is Wayne Hughes, and when did you come across this book and realize its importance to your, you know, career as a Marine Corps officer?
So Wayne Hughes, he was actually a Navy captain, career surface warfare officer, served a number of decades ago. He wrote three different editions of Fleet Tactics. The first version was called Fleet Tactics. The second edition, which came out around 2000, was Fleet Tactics and Coastal Combat. And then just in the last couple of years, had the third edition come out, which is Fleet Tactics and Naval Operations. I always kind of knew about the book in my professional career, sort of as an adjacent services book. I never really picked it up until the Marine Corps had decided to go back to its naval roots under the commandancy of General Berger here in the last couple of years. So with him, he's had a whole initiative of returning to the sea and returning to a deep partnership with the U.S. Navy. Various aspects of that have to do with restoring something called the Fleet Marine Force, which is essentially a command relationship that allows the Marines to work in direct support of naval commanders' objectives at sea. That's a pretty big change from the way the Marine Corps has been operating really since World War II in Korea, when we've been acting as a second land army, working very closely with Army commanders and trying to attain land objectives. So it's a different way of fighting and trying to understand how our new naval partners work. Picking up Fleet Tactics by Captain Hughes, it was very important because it's sort of an unofficial Bible on how the Navy fights. While it is not doctrinal per se, it is not an official publication, most naval tacticians worth their salt do end up reading that book at some point or other. It is well understood within the U.S. Navy as very descriptive of how naval fighting works. And if the Marine Corps is going to understand naval warfare, if we're going to return to our naval roots, then we very much need to understand how the Navy fights so we can be a good partner for whatever the maritime theory of success is going to be.
I'll mention just for context some of the things that are motivating this transformation of the Marines. You've laid out pretty well how for most of the 20th century, the Marines were kind of like this second land army, or as Congress mandated, they'd be a ready force that was able to deploy quickly. The army would take a long time to build up, and the Marines would just be there. The trouble, as the commandant sees it, is China, for the most part. We're not expecting a land war where we have to land on Chinese beaches, but the Chinese have built up this vast web of what are sometimes called anti-access.
Yeah, anti-access area denial. That's the term that's in vogue.
And the idea is that these ADA2 weapons and more or less the entire Chinese strategy is about keeping the United States Navy, keeping the United States Air Force and other assets we might have as far away from Chinese shores as possible. And in this situation, the old Marine Corps, which was organized around Marine Expeditionary Units, which might be sent on basically mini aircraft carriers to these theaters, is no longer a tenable model when the Chinese might be able to just shoot things down. So the Marine Corps has to rethink what it's doing. And the Commandant's answer is, well, okay, we're going to try and station forces inside this bubble already, and we're going to try to use them to support the fleet and really be integrated with what the Navy's doing. And so that leads to what you've pointed out here and something you've written in some of your articles for the Marine Corps, this need for the Marine Corps to start thinking through how navies fight, because the Marine Corps is now going to be assigned to fighting in support of the Navy instead of, say, what it's been in Afghanistan or Iraq, where the Navy was the one doing the support role.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I will say that the Marine Expeditionary Unit, the afloat Marine forces that are ready to do amphibious things, those are not going anywhere. And in fact, they're under a pretty significant redesign right now. They're going to continue to be a feature of Marine Corps operations at sea into the foreseeable future. But yes, you are correct as well that, yeah, China is very much presenting a significant operational problem for the Navy. An approach the Marines are taken to try to address the problem is by putting the shoe on the other foot, by also turning those waters and placing capabilities on allied islands, whether that happens to be our treaty allies in the Pacific and other partners or compact nations that we have close relations with, placing forces on those islands that could contest Chinese control of those seas, at least on a military level. And doing so, that's where the Navy comes into playing. I guess the idea there for the Marines is that we could, in rolling back those Chinese threats, we could lend freedom of maneuver to U.S. naval forces and to allied and partner naval forces that want to transit and operate in those areas.
And, you know, I agree with you that this book, Fleet Tactics, is kind of essential for people to understand what is going on here. Your audience is often a little bit different when you've talked about how this book is important, because you're addressing other Marine officers who are used to fighting on land. But I can give a pitch to perhaps my audience, which is going to be composed of a lot of people who are civilians like myself. When I started writing about these issues a few years ago, I really kind of struggled to be as smart as I needed to be. I've talked to you about this before, that when I was young, I wanted to go in the Marine Corps. They wouldn't let me come in because of health problems, but I kept up this interest in military and strategic affairs. But at a certain point, you have to understand what conflict looks like at the lower level in order to have intelligent insights at the strategic level. And so I would say I read this book maybe 2-3 years ago, and it was immensely helpful for me being able to understand the contours of what U.S.-China competition would be. It was one of two books I read. The other book I read was called Maritime Competition in a Mature Precision Strike Regime by Andrew Kapanovich. It's a CSBA product. And the two of them together gave me a much stronger understanding of what is actually going on here. I'm not naturally a weapons guy. I have to make little flashcards to remember what are all of these missiles, Dongfeng 21 versus all the other numbers. And I had trouble understanding how these statistics I might be learning about what the range of a weapon is or what the capabilities of this ship are, how they fit together into a larger picture. And that's exactly what I think this book does. It gives you a really intelligent framework for understanding why naval combat works the way it does, and also why it is different from a lot of the assumptions we have about combat come from the land. But maybe I should back up a little bit. Like I said, most of my readers or listeners are not going to be coming from a special military background. This book is called Fleet Tactics and Naval Operations. What does that mean? What makes tactics different from, say, naval strategy or naval operations? Could you give us a basic definition of these terms?
Yes, absolutely. So first off, tactics is fundamentally the art and the science of employing forces in combat. It's about battle. It's about actually taking combat units, whether they're ground units, whether they're air units, naval units, and taking those people, equipment, and processes to war and to attain some sort of a tactical objective. That's essentially what that is. In terms of naval strategy, that gets into the higher purposes of the whole thing. You sort of a Clausewitzian thing, basically the subordination of war to policy, or war under political aims and policy aims. That strategic dictum holds true here. We don't fight for its own sake. We always fight for a higher purpose. And so understanding what that purpose is key. Captain Hughes's book here is not about naval strategy. It's not about the use of naval power to achieve a higher purpose. It's about the actual employment of naval forces in combat.
I live in DC right now. I'm surrounded by lots of policy wonks. I like the quote that is at the beginning of the book. He has a quote from Bradley Fisk, who was an important naval officer around the turn of the 19th century. He said, "No naval policy can be wise unless it takes into very careful account the tactics that ought to be used in war." And that's what I think maybe is missing from a lot of strategic thinking in DC. I know so many people who will give me their plans for what we need to do with China, Taiwan, etc., who haven't thought very hard about what that might actually mean at the implementation level. And if you don't at least have some understanding of the tactics, you will often end up with poor strategy. Now, the reverse is true too. Tactics ends up supporting what your policy is ultimately, and strategy is the bridge between the two. But this is another reason why I recommend this book to a lot of readers who are not in the military, because it's an extremely accessible portrait of what this means. It should inform, I think, a lot of people's approach. But you want to make the case that this should also inform a lot of people in the military themselves. You've made this point in a recent Marine Corps Gazette article where you describe how Marine Corps doctrine primarily views fighting from the perspective of the man fighting on the ground, and then, quote, extrapolates those characteristics to describe warfare generally. Hughes wouldn't like this idea. Hughes believes that many of the tactical maxims that have been developed by soldiers to explain the nature of war don't really work in the naval domain. And I think he does a very convincing job of explaining why this is so. Naval warfare often works on radically different principles than what is going on at the land. But to understand that, maybe we have to first understand what is being critiqued. So if I was to open up Marine Corps Doctrinal Publication 1, War Fighting, which explains the Marine Corps' view of war and its purposes and how to win it, what is it going to tell me about the nature of war fighting that might not apply at sea?
I'll just do a quick little compare and contrast right there. Marine Corps Doctrinal Publication 1, MCDP 1, it's a quick little read. It's very accessible, essentially written at the eighth grade level, but it's stood the test of time, at least since it's come out, with the initial edition coming out in the 1980s with an update in the late 1990s. And we've been fighting with that doctrine informing the Marine Corps style of fightings ever since then. So a couple things on there. It describes a couple styles of war in there. One's called attrition warfare, and the other one is maneuver warfare. And then very, very quickly, it talks about how maneuver is essentially aiming to defeat an adversary by attacking the enemy's weaknesses, whereas attrition warfare is attacking the enemy's strengths. Essentially endorses maneuver warfare, attacking of weaknesses, is a better method of fighting. And that's probably true, at least within the land domain. So that is one specific thing. And that is one key difference that Captain Hughes actually argues against. He argues that war at sea is very, very attritional. That actually matters in terms of mindset, because Marines are trained ever since their initial training at the basic school and on the way up to think of the adversary as a system and try to find the adversary's critical vulnerabilities or his weaknesses and attack through those critical weaknesses in order to essentially take apart the adversary, have him cause him to lose his cohesion as an entity on the battlefield, and to essentially render him powerless. We call that systemic disruption. Systemic disruption has actually come under some criticism of late, at least within the pages of the Marine Corps Gazette, with some other authors questioning its viability and questioning whether it's actually ever really happened as a matter of empirically looking at the history of things. As far as I'm concerned, that's something open debate and it has not been settled yet. But in terms of the way the Marine Corps approaches warfighting, it's very much like seeking out the adversary's weaknesses and attacking through them in order to cause him to lose his cohesion. That's essentially the maneuverist approach. But in terms of where Captain Hughes comes into play here, he's very much an attritionist. He's all about seeking out the strength of the adversary. The only way to destroy an adversary is, as far as he's concerned, to destroy him through firepower.
Before we jump too far into Hughes, maybe a practical example might be a good idea to give people an idea of what the Marines mean by maneuver warfare. I've recently been reading quite a bit about the First Gulf War. This is often seen as a textbook maneuver warfare success, both in terms of systemic disruption, although the Air Force especially likes to run with that idea that they have this huge bombing campaign, which destroys a lot of the nodes, degrades the system. But when the Bush administration, the first one, was figuring how are we going to attack Kuwait, the initial plans they had said, well, okay, we might just go straight in where the Iraqis have dug in on the Kuwaiti-Saudi border. And this is where they've massed their force. And maybe what we need to do is just go straight in. But what they ended up doing was something quite different. They ended up doing this positional hook where they come around and hit them on the flanks where they're a little bit less prepared. And that is kind of what maneuver warfare is about. It's very positional, right? A lot of it is about finding the place where you can then attack them through their weakness and getting your forces there before the enemy.
Yes, typically the Gulf War, the counter invasion of the coalition forces to liberate Kuwait back in 1991 is seen as a maneuver warfare success. So is Operation Iraqi Freedom. But you can also go back in time too. Potentially a version of that would be using Marine Corps forces to land at Incheon back during Operation Chromite to reverse the successes of the North Koreans after they invaded South Korea back in 1950. That's an example. Another potential example would be a sort of blitzkrieg tactics that were used by Germany, or potentially some tactics that were used by General Patton as well. And some of it going back to even World War I. A lot of the genesis material for maneuver warfare, how it came about was basically is trying to deal with the problem of positional warfare as it presented itself on the front, in particular the spring 1918 offensive by the Germans against the Allies in World War I, with the use of specialized stormtroopers or stormtroop tactics to try to find weak spots in Allied lines. You train troops to basically pierce those areas and then bring in follow-on troops behind them to seize trench works and what have you. Those are all great examples of that. And then through history, adding armor, adding aircraft, adding longer range artillery, all those things can be used to basically support the attacking of adversary weaknesses and then exploitation of that attack by bringing in forces behind them and following up those gains with additional firepower, additional troops in order to essentially dissolve the adversary away.
If you look at those examples, the thing that strikes me about all of them is how geographic they are, or positional is probably the proper word. The landing in Incheon, that works because you're landing behind the North Korean lines and disrupting their entire system. The stormtrooper tactics at the end of World War One are about basically being able to infiltrate the Allied lines and then open up paths that weren't there before. It is very much about where things are on the map versus the other forces and how this disrupts their ability to work as a cohesive whole. But this is not how naval battle works. That's one of Hughes's main points. In fact, he has this comment, quote, "At sea, all warfare is non-linear warfare." That's one of his ways of addressing this point. What does he mean by that when he says all warfare at sea is non-linear warfare?
Yeah, I'll just go back real quick there. I do agree that the way the Marine Corps, that maneuver warfare, there's a very positional component to it. The way the Marine Corps articulates that too is they say you can also maneuver in time. So trying to think about when the adversary may be weak in time and trying to position an attack for that, or also seek out potentially moral weakness. So find a way of attacking an enemy through that. That can be difficult. How do I actually like literally attack an enemy's moral something with an M16? Sometimes that can be a challenge, but sometimes it's doable. But that is one thing that the Marine Corps says about stuff, is essentially about seeking weaknesses in the adversary, whether it's in time, whether it's in place, and potentially finding like moral or mental weaknesses to exploit as well. So that's one way of how the Marine Corps characterizes things. Naval tactics are nonlinear, though. It's interesting because when you conceptualize a fleet in the water, it's all these ships, it's these boats, it's submarines, it's aircraft, it's mobile. A destroyer can move several hundred nautical miles in a single day, as can an aircraft carrier. A whole carrier strike group can move that far. So they're very, very mobile, which means that fleets are mobile. And that means that adversary fleets are also mobile. So there's constant maneuvering against one another. In the water, there's really no terrain. There are maritime choke points, there are straits, and there are islands around there. Those do matter. But when you idealize naval combat at sea, a lot of times those other features fall away. Since the fleets are able to maneuver and countermaneuver, there's not really a way of presenting a weakness. Additionally, since we have rotating turrets and vertically launched missile systems and sensors that can basically scan in every single direction, there's not really a flank for a fleet either. There's not really a weakness that you can attack. For example, if I have a carrier strike group out there, an aircraft carrier, 3 to 4 destroyers, a couple cruisers, potentially a submarine or two, and then there's an oiler out there. Essentially, it's a combatant ship, but it's not heavily armed. It's just carrying fuel. For a Marine to conceptualize that fleet, they may go ahead and try to attack that oiler because that might be seen as the weakest part of the fleet. But since I'm going to be in combat with these guys, and I start shooting at them and they're going to be shooting at me, if I'm not using all of my energy against their offensive power, if I'm not trying to attrit that offensive power down, I'm going to be wasting that ammunition on that oiler. It's not actually going to do anything to affect their offensive power. It may do it in a few days, but by that point, the whole situation will be kind of moot. The issue at hand is, how do I address their firepower? So that's essentially the problem there. The fleet doesn't present a positional weakness to attack. It can constantly maneuver around, and we can maneuver around too, which means that trying to find that weak spot is going to be a real, real challenge. It means that the better approach is to progress, seek the destruction of the adversary's offensive power as fast as you can. That's a very big change in thinking from how Marines fight. We tend to seek the adversary where he's weak, and the Navy tends to seek the adversary where he's strong. It requires a different kind of mindset, a different way to conceptualize the enemy.
I think a corollary of a lot of this, if you think about a land battle, it's possible to dig in. It's possible to have strong geographic advantages. There's a little bit of that in the Navy, right? There's choke points. If you're in submarines, there's a difference between shallow and deeper water when it comes to anti-submarine warfare capabilities. But for the most part, you're on a featureless sea, which means that you don't have the defensive advantage that troops have in the, for example, we just talked about Kuwait, where they've dug in and there's a weak and a strong spot. That doesn't exist on the ocean. This means that there's a different calculation. Clausewitz famously said that the defense is stronger than the attack. You'll hear different numbers, but there's often this assumption that if you are the attacker, you need a 3-to-1 advantage, or you need to have some weakness that you can exploit. But this logic doesn't really work on the sea, does it?
No, it's 100% right. As an idealized form, the sea is featureless. There is bad weather out there. There are sea states. There is shallow water. Even in the air over the sea, things matter out there too. Like an aircraft that's higher up will generally have an advantage over one that's lower. Those things all do matter, but in terms of the effects of terrain at sea versus on land, there's not really a terrain effect at sea, right? Everybody's fighting at sea level. If you're a ship that's below sea level, you better be a submarine or you're dead. So your issues out there are to strike first and to locate the adversary as fast as you can. Gets back to Captain Hughes's dictum, to either fire effectively first or to attack effectively first. Every one of those words matters. Attack, that means I'm employing offensive power. It also means I've scouted for the enemy as well, and I found him hopefully first and hopefully unawares. Effectively, that also means something too. If I'm just attacking, but the attacks aren't effective, then it doesn't really matter. And hitting first, that matters too, because ships compared to land, they're actually delicate. There's no way I can really sink an island. but there's a whole bunch of ways you can sink a ship and off, or at least to get to wreck the ship to such a point where it's not a factor in the battle anymore. You know, one or two good missile hits on a ship that has that managed to leak through a ship's defenses, that will take a ship out of the fight for the foreseeable part of a battle. All it gets down to attack effectively first, scout for the adversary. When you scout for the adversary, find the adversary's strength and bring all firepower to bear that you can against it. One additional thing too is in land combat, we oftentimes set aside reserves. We set aside infantry reserves and armor and what have you for exploitation. You don't do that at sea. If you have a scouting unit out there, it better be scouting. It better be seeking the adversary at all times. And if you have any firepower, as soon as you find that enemy fleet, you want to concentrate that firepower as fast as you possibly can, because that's your greatest chance for success. So it's a very different approach to maneuver, and it's a different approach to use of your forces. And yeah, they do talk about, at least on land, the defense is the strongest form of combat. That goes back to Clausewitz, and Clausewitz is frequently cited within MCDP1. There's almost no navalists or naval officers who are mentioned within the Marine Corps Doctrinal Publication series. And that shows, because we continually talk about seeking the adversary weakness and not the strength. So this book on fleet tactics here by Captain Hughes, it is a substantially different way of approaching battle.
We've been talking a lot about how war and sea is a process of attrition. That's one of Hughes's main ideas. Naval warfare, he says, quote, centers on the process of attrition. I think, though, that many of my listeners might misunderstand that, because when you say attrition, the first thing they're going to think is World War I trenches, where you have waves and waves of men, the Battle of the Somme, being sent to the battlefield in this attempt to wear down the other person gradually over time. Naval warfare is not like that. Hughes makes a point of saying that naval warfare is, in fact, much more likely to have decisive battles than land warfare is. So we might have to, maybe the gap between the popular perception of attrition basically being World War II mowing people down years at a time, and the way that Hughes is using this term, because attrition doesn't necessarily mean a World War I setup.
Yeah, it comes down to, I sort of said earlier, attacking the enemy's strength. What is the thing that gives the enemy his power? It's his offensive power, right? Potentially his ability to maneuver in a naval combat. They're shooters and they're maneuvering. There's not really a way for me to attack supply depots in a way that would affect a tactical battle. It's not saying those things wouldn't be desirable. They are, but in the actual conduct of naval battle where I have forces arrayed against one another, yes, you seek the attrition, the destruction of those enemy units.
I think one way to talk about it is that maneuver warfare and a lot of the stuff that the Air Force and the Army and the Marines have theorized is about degrading the enemy's system as a whole, its ability to function as a coherent whole. That's why there's often a lot of focus on destroying their supply or their command and control. But the Navy, at the end of the day, it's actually about destroying the other people's fleet. It's about destroying the actual forces.
That's true. And to be sure, there's, at least at the tactical level, there's merit to that. At some point, even for the Lance Corporal with a rifle in the Marine Corps, at some point, every attack starts turning into a frontal assault. So there's a degree, it is implied within maneuver doctrine that maneuver warfare will include a degree of attrition and sometimes very, very large amounts of it. It just depends on where you're doing it. So if you're doing the attrition, particularly like a weak spot or a very important spot for the adversary, that's where you make your money.
Well, there's a psychological element to that too, right? That's another difference between an army and a navy. It's easy for an army to run away. It's easy for commanders to lose control of their officers and everyone to split up. That's what we see in the example I've been using quite a lot, the Gulf War, where the Iraqi army disintegrates under pressure. A fleet can't do that. The officers are not going to have their sailors run away from the ship. It's not possible. So the psychological element matters less than the technological element. That's another idea that Hughes has. Not that psychology doesn't matter, but the dynamic of messing with the other side is really...
So one of Hughes's sort of foundational points is that sailors matter most. He says that. So like morale a willingness to work through difficulty. All those things actually matter very, very much on an individual level. But yes, you are also correct that there is no way for a sailor to run away from a battle. To a certain extent, morale does matter, but also to a certain extent, like once you've taken a catastrophic kill on a ship, your morale at that point kind of doesn't matter anymore, at least as far as the battle goes. One series of battles, at least within naval history, probably would give a good idea of how naval combat is. Would be the various battles that occurred around Guadalcanal back in World War II. For the Marines, Guadalcanal is a very important story. It's in our lore. We largely tell the story of the 1st and, to a lesser extent, the 2nd Marine Divisions ashore. To a lesser extent, we tell the story of the 1st Marine Aircraft Wing and the Cactus Air Force that were located there. But we Marines, we often forget the very important role that the Navy played in the fact the actual campaign out there was really a naval campaign. The whole purpose for taking the airfield on Guadalcanal was to project power at sea in order to regain sea control. That was the whole point of the thing. So in some ways, the Marine battles ashore, while important, they're kind of a sideshow to the broader importance of what the Navy was doing. So there's a series of battles out there, Battle of Cape Esperance, Battle of Savo Island, the Naval Battle of Guadalcanal, all happened within this area. The area that it occurred in was called Iron Bottom Sound. Why Iron Bottom Sound? Because so many ships went down there, both Japanese and American. In terms of the numbers of casualties that the Navy took versus the Marines and the other services that were there, the Navy far outstripped the numbers of casualties, and almost all those casualties were aboard ship in very fiery and very nasty deaths. So it was quite a trying ordeal for the Navy, and it's a shame that we Marines sometimes forget about that. There's no conceivable way that two fleets, because the nature of that combat is so offensive, that two fleets can persist in a single area without enormous amounts of fighting. And that leads to the decisive nature of naval operations. It's not really so on land. You can have intermingling of forces. You can have infiltration of forces. You can have troops dig into terrain and other troops trying to outmaneuver them. They may bump into each other and may get into combat. It may rise up and it may die down. It may become cataclysmic or may turn into a little bit of nothing. So the nature of combat on land can be quite a bit different than the way you fight at sea. If you see an enemy ship out there or if it's detected, the nature of that combat is going to make it decisive. It has to be that way because the fighting is so very offensive. And ironically, because it's so decisive, we've actually had relatively few naval battles since World War II. There was the Falklands battle between Argentina and Great Britain. That was the first battle in the Missile Age, or first series of battles in the Missile Age. But by and large, the story of the last 70, 80 years has been one of American dominance on the seas. So the very decisiveness of the naval battles and the overmatch that the American fleets and allied fleets have had caused them to not be so many battles. But as soon as an enemy fleet puts to sea and as soon as hostilities begin, you can count on those the battle becoming very bloody, very quickly, and very, very decisive.
The general principle, though, it's not entirely due to America's naval strength over the last 50 years. Hughes points this out. If you look at the 100 years before World War II, or the three centuries before, the number of battles fought at sea is less than that fought on land. And when they are fought, they tend to be more decisive. It's for exactly the reasons you describe. Fleets are really expensive. They're very vulnerable. If you look at, say, World War I, where there's only one major fleet action, this happens precisely because sides realize how vulnerable fleets really are to being attacked. And that leads to one of the other maxims in this book, which is that naval warfare is about attacking effectively first. This is kind of an important idea. It's an idea that I think has strategic consequences that people don't realize. In a naval battle, you need to be the side that hits first. Why is this? Why does it matter so much that you attack first?
Well, it gets down again to the very nature of the problem, especially in the Missile Age, especially with the various sensors, sonar, radar, visual observers, unmanned aircraft. All these things aid the attacker. That combined with the very delicate nature of ships, it's very difficult to blend in at sea and without terrain around you, without the advantages of camouflage and the ability to dig in. All that stuff lends itself toward increased offensive power of fleets. which means that your best bet is finding the enemy fleet first and attacking it as fast as you possibly can. That is your bid for success. And indeed, there are battles out there where this sort of thing was key. The Battle of Midway was very important for the U.S. Navy in World War II. Even the score in terms of capital ships sunk against the Empire of Japan, a key aspect of it was locating the enemy fleet first and then concentrating our aircraft against the enemy fleet carrier. The key offensive power of the Japanese fleet was their aircraft carriers. So there was absolutely essential that those be taken out of the action as fast as they possibly could. All that basically adds up into the importance of firing effectively first. And corollary to that is finding the enemy first and firing against them and having your attacks be effective. So,
well, you know, this can be expressed mathematically, and Hughes does it quite a bit in the book, just to provide a very simple model for people to understand what we're talking about. Imagine you have two fleets. Both of them have four aircraft carriers, as an example. And just assume that if you have four aircraft carriers, and if you can fire off however many of your diver bombers, if we're talking about World War II, you have the ability to sink two aircraft carriers with your four. And then if you have two aircraft carriers, you probably have the ability to sink one. If these four aircraft carrier fleets are out there in the Pacific looking for each other, the first one to become aware of the other and to attack it will be able to send off all of its planes, and it will sink two of the enemy. Now, at this point, the enemy only has two left, and he can send his planes out, and he'll probably be able to sink one of the first group. All of a sudden, you are left with two versus three. Originally had four versus four. And then the next wave down, the three aircraft carriers, they can definitely sink the remaining carriers on the enemy side. They're just gone. This is why the logic of attrition works. If you are able to remove a significant number of the enemy capabilities on the first salvo round, then their ability to damage you in that round is much less. And then the second round, you'll have that much more power over them. And they'll have less and less and less until they're gone. That's the logic. It works for planes, but also for missiles. We haven't seen too many major actions. The Falklands War is the closest we have. But it seems to follow that same logic. Whoever attacks first has the ability to disable large parts of the opponent, which in turn means that they have less ability to hit back. And that's kind of the basic logic of what's going on here.
And it's to the detriment of many Marines that they don't understand or have not been exposed to that logic. That's a weakness of our doctrine, is that they're not taught the advantages of the cumulative advantages of offensive power over time. That's effectively what you laid out there. As turns of combat go down, the advantage of the team that's winning the bouts is going to generally increase over time. Now they are going to be running around scouting for each other, trying to find the enemy. And as soon as they find that enemy, they're going to be concentrating the offensive power against the most powerful thing with the expectation that it will be taken off the board with the first round, and then the understanding on subsequent rounds that piece will not be available anymore. Again, this is a model. You basically built a model in your head of how combat would go down. Real life doesn't exactly follow models, but models aren't completely wrong either. I mean, they can be used to inform good decisions. So with that understanding, if we place naval capabilities ashore, but under the command of a fleet for the purposes of fleet action, that add capability to the fleet. If we place naval aviation ashore and refueling facilities and aviation ordnance and sensors, whether they're surface search radars or command and control facilities, radio repeater sites, and similar types of things, they can add to both the offensive power of the fleet as well as add to its resiliency, because those capabilities are much more difficult to take out on a permanent basis than a ship is. If we employ forces ashore in concert with forces at sea, we could potentially present the adversary with some pretty difficult things to overcome.
That's the logic that the Chinese have used themselves. They've developed the PLA rocket force. The PLARF more or less exists on that logic. If you can reach out to the sea from land, you can cause America's ability to protect force a lot of problems. Although I would like to see more models of this. I suspect that if you're having rocket valleys between, say, the Marine Corps and the rocket force, that it actually will follow a similar pulse logic that in many ways might be more similar to naval warfare than maneuver warfare?
I think the logic of missile warfare, and a lot of this goes back to nuclear weapons. If we have two nuclear states, each armed with intercontinental ballistic missiles like the U.S. and Russia in the Cold War, it becomes a game of using my nuclear weapons to destroy their nuclear weapons and assured second strike. Do they have the ability to strike back? All that stuff. A lot of this has been modeled out already, and there's probably something that can be transferred over here. So there's probably reason to believe that missile combat, whether at land or at sea, is the offense probably has primacy over the defense. Nonetheless, there's still salvo math involved. If I have forces ashore, and if the Chinese or the Russians or some other adversary needs to expend missiles against those forces ashore, those missiles are not being expended against the fleet, unless they have incredible amounts of overmatch. And even then, the ability to truly destroy forces ashore is difficult. It's surprisingly difficult because we have the ability to disperse. We have the ability of, you know, blending in with populations. These units will be placed within range of those enemy weapon systems on land. There's something called stand-in forces. Those stand-in forces would actually stand inside the weapons engagement zone of the adversary, and they're probably going to be fairly resilient. One additional thing is that every bit of land on the earth is owned by a government. The sea is not that way. Countries really only control through sovereignty up to 12 nautical miles, and they have an exclusive economic zone more or less out to 200 from their shores. So that being the case, like if you fire off a missile in the international waters, it doesn't have the same weight as shooting a missile at a country which has a mutual defense treaty with the United States.
So this is a pretty good example of where kind of tactical realities filter up to have strong policy implications. Another one I think about a lot, if competition with China is mostly based on competition at sea and to a lesser extent at air and then with missile forces, you have in many ways now a strategic setting where the power lies with the offense. It lies with the person who strikes first for the reasons we've been describing. And this has really strong strategic and policy implications for maintaining deterrence and in terms of making a strong, stable international environment. In a way, I feel like it's harder. Another way to think about this, if you read Sarah Payne's SCM Payne is her pen name, books on World War II history and the history of Imperial Japan, she often suggests that the Japanese had a strategic culture where they would use surprise. She goes from the Battle of Tsushima all the way through Pearl Harbor as examples of this, where they have this culture of strategic fleet action surprise. And when I read Hugh's book, it makes me think maybe that's not actually what was going on. It might not even be that, oh, Japanese are particularly tricky that forces them to do Pearl Harbor-like actions. But this is rather a logical extension of the tactical realities of attacked effectively first. If whoever is able to hit the other person first is very likely to win the decisive action, then you have a very strong incentive to be the person who does that. If that means a Pearl Harbor style attack where you go ahead and hit the other person, because if it's a surprise, then you know where their fleet is in peacetime, as in Pearl Harbor, you will have a very strong incentive to do that. Or in a different scenario, if there's tensions being raised in the South China Sea or something along those lines, where battle is more and more likely of a possibility, just thinking that it's more likely to happen means that your side, and really either side, it could be the Chinese or the United States in this case, will have a much stronger incentive than was possible in most land warfare to hit the other side while they still can, to get that first mover advantage.
I think that's right. To the extent that Japan is a naval or a maritime culture, and they very much are, yeah, there probably is something potentially in the Japanese culture that is about attacking first and the use of surprise, both at the strategic and at the tactical level, all that matters. But that's also very much endemic to air combat. It's endemic to missile combat, and it's endemic to naval combat.
Right. I mean, they don't even really need that strategic culture to have that same
sense. Or if they have it, it may be derived from the fact that they're a maritime culture in the first place. What's the influence of sea power on history? Alfred Thayer Mahan wrote that. You also wrote, what's the influence of sea power on cultures? The influence of sea power on cultures could very much lead you to take a tactically offensive mindset on those things. Now, by the same token, there were probably some people on both sides of the Pacific at the time who thought that taking such an offensive action against the United States, at least at the tactical level, may yield some benefits of sinking a whole bunch of battleships by dint of the fact that the aircraft carriers were largely at sea. Those weren't hit at Pearl Harbor, but they did manage to awaken a massive sleeping giant, which had war plans on the books for literally decades for prosecuting a war against Japan. All that is written up in a very, very good book called War Plan Orange. It's a pretty nerdy book. I'm a guy who likes the history of planning. It talks about the evolution of that plan from the early 1900s all the way through World War II, how it changed over time.
Well, the Japanese are perhaps an example of what happens if you let tactics drive strategy.
100%. That's exactly where I was going to go with that. Another culture that has been criticized as having the same kind of mindset as actually Germany, another foe from World War II and World War I for that matter. Remember, for the United States, World War I essentially started with a naval action at sea between the U.S. and Germany, them sinking a large merchant ship. So what is the value of taking a tactical victory?
In my mind, the fact that countries will adopt stupid strategies or policies because they're driven by the logic of tactics is an even stronger argument that policymakers and high-level strategists need to understand tactics. Otherwise, they won't know what logic they'll be driven by, right? They have to, 100%. Have to understand this.
A key thing to think about is a naval war, which we have not had in a long, long time. No one in living memory within the United States Navy or Marine Corps or really anywhere in the policy apparatus, to include the president, all the way on down. No one has been alive for a major fleet action that resulted in the sinking of an American ship anywhere. If you get into a naval confrontation between the United States and China, where we are trying to attack each other's ships, that is a certainty. There is not a way you are escaping that without taking at least a degree of missile shots at various ships. Now, how does that escalate? No one really knows. It really depends on the circumstances of how it goes down. Is it a surprise attack or a sneak attack? Does it occur in international waters? Are things explained? Who acted first? Who did what when? Does it immediately evolve into a nuclear confrontation?
That's a strong argument in my mind for like the United States and China coming up with a set of procedures for managing escalation, knowing that if you're in a place like the South China Sea and something happens, knowing that the logic is going to be on both sides to jump up and take out their fleet before they take your fleet. You want to have very strong precautions in place. And this is in many ways different from our competition with the Soviets. Going through the Fulda Gap, the Red Army mobilizing and going through, as a much larger process. It would take more behind it than a fleet action would. And from either side, it's a scarier endeavor because the defense has so much strength on land.
That's a good point. One thing I will say is even during the height of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union, there were U.S. Navy and Soviet Navy, military to military, Navy to Navy contacts where they every so often would get together and talk about the various actions that occurred at sea with the aim at reducing risk. We have not had the same type of relationship with the People's Liberation Army Navy and the Chinese Communist Party. And that is not, in my opinion, that is not a positive thing. We probably need to have procedures in place to manage those types of expectations. But it's difficult. You have a declining power on one hand there, and then you have a rising power on another in the form of China with very different geopolitical interests and a very different relationship with the international order, i.e. they trade a lot. They have a very large and a growing economy. So calculations are different. Is there any incentive for them to go ahead to try to manage the confrontation if they think in their mind that they may end up being stronger in several years' time in order to get a better deal with against the United States? So all those things go into the
calculus. I think that there is an incentive on their part. because at the end of the day, civilian leaders want to be in control. If you're Xi Jinping, you don't want the war to happen without you being the one who wants the war to happen. So there probably needs to be a discussion at some point where American officials, diplomats in the State Department, people in the National Security Council, whoever, very frankly discuss what we are discussing. The logic of the offensive is true in the Pacific. Because of that, it leads to strategic instability. Civilian leaders in both places have a strong interest in controlling when they go to war. If they want to do a surprise attack, fine. But, I mean, not fine. I don't want that to happen. But what we don't want to have happen is just things that escalate out of control because there are not policy controls on top of tactical realities. And that's a real possibility. Well, we don't have too much time left, but there is another question or two I wanted to ask you. And this also, I think, has some kind of policy implications. One of the other major themes of Hughes' book is the importance of scouting. Hughes identifies growing importance of scouting as one of the major trends of the last 200 years. I think he says that, quote, tactical commanders have to devote more of their attention to scouting and less to delivery of firepower. That is the trend of the last 200 years of naval warfare. And he also says that better scouting, more than maneuver, as much as weapon range, and oftentimes than anything else, has determined victory. This makes sense in the context of what we said, right? If attacking first is how you win, then the side that finds the other side first has a very strong advantage. So my question is, how do the Marines fit into this picture? The Marine Corps wants to gear up with all sorts of long-range precision fires. Are they just going to be using other people's scouting capabilities, or do they have something to add to this? Scouting seems like the big weakness in the U.S. approach, especially if we can't rely on satellites completely.
Just for the purposes of, like, laying out terms, like, let's just describe what scouting is. Literally on page 3 of the book, talks about means surveillance, code breaking, other ways to obtain and report combat information to commanders and their forces. So that's what scouting is in terms of what Hughes is. I think what you're doing there is you're making an assumption in terms of what would exist after an initial bout between the United States and China. Assuming they have a strong fleet and they want to deny areas to the United States Navy and our allies and partners, and also understand that they have space power, so they have the ability to knock out satellites, ability to conduct cyber operations. Part of cyber operations would potentially be used to affect electronic, computer-based position, navigation, timing systems that just about every ship and aircraft in the world uses these days. So if you have an adversary with those types of capabilities, what can the Marines provide? So the issue there is trying to find the enemy and then trying to get that information to somebody. And that's actually, in my opinion, probably the most important thing that the Marines can provide the fleet. Putting Marine forces ashore with various sensor technologies, some of which are in existence right now, some of them are fielded and some are not quite fielded yet, have the potentially the capability to locate adversary ships and aircraft and submarines and other types of features in the operating environment that would be of importance to us, and trying to pass that information on as quietly and surreptitiously as we can. That is not without precedent. Another key aspect of the Battle of Guadalcanal, which I mentioned earlier, involved an irregular sort of a unit that was organized by Australia called the Coast Watchers. All that they were essentially were Australians and Australian-friendly people who were scattered around these Pacific islands. A bunch of them had ham radios and other means of communications. Armed with binoculars, they would report the movements of enemy ships and aircraft. Where this was important for Guadalcanal is Japanese aircraft would take off from the home islands or other islands to head south toward Guadalcanal. These coast watchers would relay that news to the American forces on Guadalcanal and allow them to take action. And that was particularly important because American aircraft at that time were inferior to Japanese aircraft. And so the only way they can get the advantage they needed to fight the Japanese aircraft was to spin up to a higher altitude as fast as they possibly could when they got the word. And so while the Japanese aircraft were transiting to Guadalcanal to have the air battle, American aircraft were spiraling up to a higher altitude so that when the Japanese showed up, they could try to attack them from a position of higher altitude. That was essentially the only way they were able to gain advantage on the adversary at that point. So coast watchers back then playing a really critical reconnaissance and scouting role were utterly critical towards Marine Corps action and by extension, action by the fleet. So that type of capability, that's existed in the past and we made use of it. Where Marines can do it nowadays is we have modern and advanced sensors, Marines placed in key places around various islands and key maritime terrain can relay very important reports, targeting information, what have you, to American and allied ships and command and control centers in order for them to take appropriate fleet action.
How integrated is that, though, both with the Navy and with other allied powers? It's one thing to be able to sense things.
In a lot of ways, I think the allied powers thing is more difficult because you run into classification problems. And that's all I'll say about that. But trying to share information between governments can be a challenge. Militaries from foreign governments can be a challenge.
Well, when I wrote about the Marine Corps in my foreign policy article last year, that was one of my concerns with the Marine Corps shift. If you're doing beyond the horizon fires, you need people who can do the targeting. And if you're firing from allied countries, you need very specific policy procedures in place to authorize these things. And also to authorize the sharing of intelligence and signals information so that like this whole system's even possible.
100%. I completely agree. And I need to trust that the intelligence community and our diplomats are working that problem because it's a need to get these things. And I know that with some countries, there are very good sharing arrangements with some countries, essentially seamless ones. And then there are other ones that could probably use some work. So yes, that is a key piece of the problem. Another aspect that you mentioned, just getting the information around. And I promise you that the U.S. Marine Corps and the U.S. Navy are keenly interested on how you push that information around. I can just assure you that we're exercising toward that problem essentially as we speak.
Right. If the Marine Corps was not doing this at this point, it would be a really big failure to implement the Commandant's vision, I suppose.
Yeah, it's an identified problem, right? It's an identified operational problem. It's an identified tactical problem. And it's even a technical problem on some levels. And we're talking about things like individual message formats and what's the medium you're transferring this information on. When you send it, is it being received in the right format where somebody can make use of it, or you know, transfer it into a weapon system or a missile so that it can be used for an engagement? All of that gets into it. So there's the process of reconnaissance and surveillance and intelligence on one hand, and then target acquisition, and even things like identification of friendly versus foe and getting updates to targeting information because adversary ships are constantly moving, so you need to constantly update it. All those things get into the problem, but the fact that it's, in a lot of cases, these problems are technical in nature, and oftentimes are engineering solutions that are available that we're all very much working on.
Okay, final question before I let you go, and that's that. So let's say the Marine Corps does what you would like, and they all read Hughes Fleet Tactics and then other works on naval strategy like you have recommended in your Marine Corps Gazette articles. What changes would this lead to? What would be different? What would you like to see happen?
What I would like to see happen is this for the Marine Corps. I would like us to rethink. It's a thinking game. Right? We need to rethink how we conceptualize what war is. For too long, we've approached the issue of what war is from a very landward-centric point of view, because we've been acting as a second land army, even within our sort of service DNA. Like Marines aboard ship, the first thing they oftentimes think of is, I want to get off the ship as fast as I can and get ashore and do my job there. That needs to change a little bit. We need to instead rethink what war is in various domains. The seat of purpose may be on land, but the battle may be at sea. And that is why Marines need to really rethink what it means to be naval in character and what it means to support a maritime theory of success. That's what I would like to change, is essentially wholesale rethinking among the officer corps and the senior enlisted professionals within the corps on what that means. And then additionally, a change for the Navy is I would like to see them really partner with us. They're very much interested in having a willing partner that's willing to go to sea and to work for our nation's interests and hopefully maintain the peace and, if necessary, go to war with. That's a long relationship the Marine Corps has had with the Navy. The Marine Corps has some responsibility in allowing that relationship to fray over the course of the last 70 years since the end of World War II, and we need it back. So I would make a bid for greater support from the Navy as well. And that's essentially what I would seek to change. And everything else is downstream from there. If you get the thinking right and you get the partnership right, the weapons will happen, the systems will happen, the people and the processes will happen, the training will happen.
Well, that is a thoughtful answer, Nate. May your cause prosper. Folks, I'm afraid we've reached the end of the show today. Those who would like to follow Colonel Lauterbach's writing in the future can follow him on Twitter at JungianThings. A link to that Twitter account, as well as to all articles, books, and battles referenced in this episode, will be provided in the show notes. A transcript of this episode is available for our Patreon supporters on the Scholars Stage website, located at scholars-stage.org. This is Tanner Greer. You'll hear from me again soon, here at the Scholar Stage.